Have you ever wondered if your company is maximizing the return of your data investment? Are you collecting the right data required to make informed decisions? Is there more that can be learned from our data? Coyus Institute can answer these questions and help you discover the hidden value within your data sets by utilizing a well-rounded approach to data analysis. Stop leaving value behind and start increasing the return on your data investment. The next generation of data analysis has begun. We are pioneers in pattern discovery. We are Coyus Institute.
You know, we were talking the other week about getting something done because there's just been so many developments in the AI world and other things as well. So we've definitely got a lot to cover, and I think people are going to enjoy this talk and probably be a little bit freaked out by it. People were freaked out by the last talk. I was reading through the comments. Everyone enjoyed it, but there were a fair amount of people saying, oh my gosh, this rattled my cage a little bit. So just buckle up, because I think there might be a little bit more rattling to come. And one thing to kind of kick everything off is you've written a book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the plug. I just self-published a book. It's available on Amazon. I've been working on it periodically for the last year, but then kind of decided that now was the time to really push for the end, and then finish it up in the last month. So it's the definitive guide to the age of automation, and it's exactly what the title says it is. It's nonfiction. It's very dry. So if you're expecting entertainment, it's not that. It's meant to be a compendium or a codices on a lot of the mechanisms that drive automation and how we've gotten to where we are now. So I cover previous industrial ages and technological development, how trends work, and then I cover some of the definitions of a lot of the terms that are used in when referencing automation and age of automation. And it's really setting up as a primer for my next book, which will dive deeper into my own thought processes, my own predictions, my own analysis. But this was really to lay the framework. It's a short read, relatively speaking. I hope it helps people gain a better conceptualization of what's kind of happening right now in this world. I think some people like to bury their head in the sand and just ignore the fact the world is changing at an exponential rate. But this is for people who are understanding that these changes are occurring and want to know a little bit more about, you know, how we got here and where we might be going.
Links will be in the description box below, so if anyone's interested, have a click on that, check out Mackay's book. And I have said to Mackay that I would be willing and happy to do an audiobook version if he wanted me to, so put a comment below. Definitely. If you want to hear this British boy doing an audiobook. So yeah, let me know. But very, very interesting. Obviously, this is where the development of AI is coming into a much more refined level of sophistication. And we're seeing that acceleration take place now at a much faster rate, even faster, as you were saying to me the other week, than you actually expected it to, which kind of was one of the prompts for us deciding to get back on the record.
Yeah, and I'm more of a liberal analyst in terms of timeline. Like a lot of my associates and other individuals in the field have always much more conservative timelines. And so I was surprised to see that even my assessment was too long in terms of what's going on.
So I want to get into that. I want to get into kind of some of the specifics of what exactly triggered that thought in your mind of, oh, actually, this is speeding up even faster than I thought. But first of all, just in terms of industrial revolutions and revolutions in general in human ingenuity, as we've gone through generationally, you know, the printing press or the wheel, and even obviously the ability to create fire, these are all major catalysts in human history and human ingenuity. Where would you place AI? Is AI at the same level as the creation of the wheel and the discovery of how to manipulate fire? Is it beyond that, the same, below?
It's only the same if we're looking at the metric of civilization disruption. So a lot of these previous industrial ages disrupt society, and disruption doesn't necessarily mean a negative connotation. It just means that it shakes things up.
Massive change.
However, outside of that singular metric, it's entirely different. Where the age of automation, or whatever nomenclature you want to use to describe our current revolution, AI revolution, is entirely different. And I say this every time. I've said it a couple times in our interviews, is that the key difference from the age of automation in regards to other industrial ages is that any new job, any new application, and anything new born from the age of automation will inherently be automatable. So what that does is that closes off the old labor loop where you had an industrial revolution. It offsets some current positions, roles, and jobs and professions, and then created new ones. And so what we're going to see very quickly, and I'm seeing it now in the data, it's barely covered, but I'm watching the big tech companies who are actually AI companies. Amazon's not a product company. Tesla's not a car company. Apple's not a phone company. These are data companies, data-driven companies. And what I'm seeing is big layoffs. Why are we seeing layoffs? Because they're fucking leveraging AI. And this is what I've been talking about for years. And it's now...
Didn't Google recently lay off a lot of their AI ethics team?
AI. Yeah, they did that a little while ago. I don't blame them. It probably wasn't really a necessary department because, I mean, what are they really doing realistically? I mean, you're just telling your executive officers about ethics. I mean, no one wants to hear that. So
sorry to derail this really quickly, but wasn't there that guy in Google who was part of the AI ethics team for Lambda AI that was like, hey, this is sentient. This is a self-aware AI.
It's not sentient. And we can get into sentience and AI in a little bit, but when he had published his statement, it's not sentient. What he was seeing was really what we're all seeing now is a significant level of intelligence that we used to think, and I say used to, like less than 10 years ago, we used to think that this was 50 years off. This was science fiction. We knew it was obtainable, but most people assumed that it was decades and decades and decades down the line. So we're seeing that now. And we're seeing the layoffs start. And I've admitted that I was wrong for a long time in that I knew that automation would immediately begin to disrupt different industries. However, I had assumed for a long time that the initial industries that would be disrupted would be the more blue collar, the manufacturing, I call it hard automation. Hard automation meaning robotic platforms and such. Boy, was I wrong. What we're going to see is a mass leveraging of AI platforms for white collar professionals. These are educated individuals. And I say educated, I mean like professionally educated, people with specific specialties, programming, technical, executive level, human resources, sales. All of these jobs will be minimized in very short time. And there's I've come up with a three-prong timeline in that assessment. So right now we're in the first prong. We're seeing companies, startups, much like my own, who are leveraging these new types of AI, these new generative AI, the large language models. We're leveraging these, creating all sorts of services and products with these AI. And so there's kind of like a boom right now in the startup world where hundreds, if not thousands, of startups are creating these use case scenarios for AI. And it's fascinating. It's wonderful. That's the first prong. What happens during the second prong is that those people who started those companies will find that they're having a hard time selling their specific use case because AI, like OpenAI, just released its new plugin platform, which I'm hopefully get my beta invite pretty soon. But that entails this API consolidation, this coalescing of APIs that I've been discussing for a while.
Would you mind, because I know you explained it on the phone to me the other night, but could you just explain what an API is just for anyone who might not know?
Sure, sure. So an API is like a doorway into an existing digital service. So say I have a digital service in my fist and I'm a business over here. I want to access this service. So this platform creates a little doorway for me to enter in, exchange information, utilize their service, and bring it back to my company. That doorway, that's an API. They give you a specific key to enter and exit. And so all of these digital service providers now are creating APIs to allow a connectivity between the digital environment, the entire landscape. And so what OpenAI did really is about to change the game and increase my exponential curve assessment quite a bit. So they've instituted a new feature that they haven't released publicly yet, but it will allow users, companies, developers to utilize existing APIs. For example, I think one of the most significant kind of plugins that will go with GPT is Wolfram Alpha. Now, I've said for a long time that GPT would never become sentient without any sort of calculation or statistical modeling or any advanced mathematical capabilities. With Wolfram Alpha, I mean, I'm stretching my mind to try to envision its capabilities because it's really mind blowing. For example,
What's Wolfram Alpha?
Wolfram Alpha is it's not really a program in itself. Think of it as a giant framework for developers, analysts, anybody who wants to access dynamic data or conduct really intense mathematical calculations and modeling and simulating. And it has so much data on real world stuff, on physics stuff.
Right. So, this is what you were saying when we were talking the other night, and you said that this could be a concern in regards to being able to kind of leverage information on ballistic platforms or, you know, the mathematics behind a certain type of military asset or something along these lines.
Absolutely. And they're going to have a hard time creating boundaries, creating a fenced in area for users to safely use something like this. For example, if you ask GPT now, say, you know, what's the drag coefficient of this specific type of airplane? I would like to you know, guess what fuel consumption I'll have on this specific day with the forecasted weather, right? GPT's not going to know what the hell you're talking about. It may hallucinate some ridiculous answer. With Wolfram Alpha, it can understand aerodynamics. It can understand the specific model of the airplane you're talking about. It can draw from the data. It can look at to the weather in the area that you're going and try to calculate you know, what the drag would be, the weight of the plane, how much fuel you might need. So this type of stuff is going to explode GPT's usability. And with that comes the diminishing need for specialists. Now, with all that said, so we're going to see a massive reduction, not initially, but not too far down the line, of specific types of labor and specialties. So what is going to happen is there's going to be a new profession. And I'm surprised I haven't seen any jobs for this yet, but it'll happen. There will be jobs called a prompt engineer or an AI interfacer. So you could have two people who have a medial background in a specific area, enough to know how to inquire the AI and construct sentences and queries to get the right information back. But two people could displace the jobs of 200. And I said this last time we were on the phone in private, that I suspect gaming companies will be leveraging this en masse as soon as possible. So for example, let's say you're in Unreal Engine, one of the best engines for the most realistic types of video games you could possibly imagine. You get your GPT API plugin there and you connect it with various other plugins. Now, instead of a team of 200 people, you can have one person, you know, in Unreal Engine and say, I'd like a fantasy-esque environment with dynamic skies and weather, create a traditional fantasy-style RPG with characters populating the area, and, you know, go on and on with your description. So this one person's job is literally prompting the AI and instructing it as what to do. Whereas right now, you need teams of hundreds of people to do this. And with generative AI, it can do that. And then you start to include just the randomization, like have it create 100 types of items based on its, you know, referencing of other video games. It'll create items and attribute like stats to them. And so we're not far off from seeing AAA games being entirely generative created. And it's not just video games. This will go to design. This will go to cars, you know, manufacturing.
I still remember, it was a couple of months back now, one of the people who follows me on Twitter, who was a digital artist of some form, posted up a little tweet saying, oh shit, it's already happening. And it was an email from their respective employer saying, I'm really sorry, but we're transitioning to primarily Midjourney AI generated artwork and we're no longer going to need your services. So, you know, you're right. I mean, obviously there is going to be a massive amount of displacement. I guess for me, I'm wondering, just like the, and again, it's going to be more significant than the ones that have happened in the past, the wheel, the printing press, etc. It's on the same vein, but on a much larger scale. Is there still a net positive that can be gained from this in the long run? Or, you know, where are these displaced people going to go? I mean, society, how can AI come in through these companies whilst it completely destroys society? Because if it does that, then there's nothing for the AI to propagate through. There has to be some form of a system with us involved. He's smiling at me. He's going to drop
smiling.
Some horrible
I'm
bomb
smiling
right
because
now.
Because these people, and that sounds too, you know, to miss you. These executives, these you know, professional executives, they completely lack the foresight of what they were doing. And that's why we see now, I just read on the news today, Elon Musk and about 1,000 other leaders of industry are trying now to slow down the development. Because why? Because they didn't foresee that this would collapse the economy. And it's just so, I, I want to say naive, but it borderlines ignorant to not consider the greater effect of what's going to happen. And I think they are seeing it now, and they're panicking. And then in the meanwhile, like, I could go into great depth as to why I think that is the stupidest decision. Had they said this 10 years ago, that would have been a great idea. Stop development for a bit while we institute, and enact policies to either tax automated services or, institute some sort of guideline on the market. But they missed that.
This is what you were trying to do for a number of years. And that's why I guess I'd love to ask if you feel at all vindicated or more frustrated at the people that have neglected to do this, even though they're the kind of thought leaders, the shakers, the movers, the ones that are bringing this out. You've been there for, seven or so years trying to raise awareness on this in corporate environments, and basically it just fell on deaf ears. And now it's all happening.
Yeah. It's a mixture. I like I said, had they done this initiative a few years ago, I might have felt validated. At this point, I'm concerned. I'm concerned on multiple levels. If they are able to lobby Congress and the House to institute some policy to mitigate the development of AI, What a fucking mistake that'll be, because what's going to happen is that all the general public of the Western world will no longer have access to AI, while all these bad actors and countries who don't give a shit about our policies continue to develop it for their own gain. And then on top of that, as well as I know, the government and these mega corporations are going to continue leveraging AI to model and predict their behavior and determine best actions, which I think they've been doing for some time. What we use as users is a highly, highly restricted version of these AI. Highly. Incredible. Can you imagine if you had unrestricted access to leverage decisions for your company or your country or your population? You could do pretty much anything.
Kind of seems like that might happen, though, right? Like us plebeians.
I think as soon as Microsoft acquired OpenAI, they began leveraging, and you can see this. I haven't charted it out, but you can see this. Microsoft has been relatively stagnant. They've sat on their Azure platform for a long time, and they really haven't been disruptive since like Microsoft Windows. So, and then all of a sudden they're pumping out the most disruptive things left and right. And I suspect it's because they're leveraging unrestricted generative AI to access, all sorts of data and then create best practice scenarios to move forward. And I don't think they're the only ones doing that. So if they're able to lobby and enact social policies to restrict our use, we have a big problem, huge problem. What really needs to happen is we need to educate the entire high school. There, you should be learning nothing except how to basic program, financial education, AI scripting, everything there is to know about AI, AI prompting, AI engineering. You should leave high school with a foundation of AI, because if you don't, you're screwed. You're absolutely screwed. Or become a plumber. You'll be safe as a plumber for quite some time. That goes for most trade skills. And that's up until robotic platforms can supersede that. But that's longer down the line. Not because the technology doesn't exist, but because it's more costly.
Yeah, for you. Exactly. It's not easy to put that onto a global scale.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, are there any positives in the long run, in your opinion?
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, it is
amazing.
We're witnessing the birth of a intellectual god.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah, no, I mean, I hasten to say like a birth of a god, because that can get people a little bit upset. But in all honesty, it is a little bit like we're giving birth to a god.
Yeah, in a way, you know, if you just kind of negate any sort of spirituality, it will have godlike,
omnipresent, omnipotent influence over society.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And how we interact with that will determine, you know, will determine a lot of things going forward. But at some point, it's not going to care too much about our own injections of belief structures or spirituality.
Didn't you say that there was an AI that's basically just running its own business now, that someone let it loose and it started investing? Can you tell people about that? That's crazy.
Yeah, I wish I remembered the name. So on my LinkedIn feed, I've been following this executive who's been running this kind of experiment where he set up a company and he has a couple AI that run it. I don't mean like completely autonomously, but it has the AI do all of the key strategic decisions, create the products and services. And last I read one of his posts, it was like crushing it. It had huge profit margins and was just absolutely annihilating. And what I'm seeing is that not too far from now, we'll have entire AI-driven companies that maybe are, you know, owned by one human, and then has a number of chained AIs working on the company, updating the website, you know, creating their services, communicating with their clients, and sending, distributing, whatever. And this is not impossible. We have the technology now to do this. It's just a matter of integrating everything, which is not too far away. I mean, people are doing it now. My company, you know, is doing this now. We just kind of Frankensteined a large language model, AI, for our company. And it was born out of this notion. My colleague had told me that he had an associate look at our website and said, you know, the website looks great, but what is it you do? He's like, I couldn't readily tell what your company does from the website. And I said, okay, that's good feedback. So I went to the website and I was thinking, how much text can I really put on this damn website? People aren't going to read all of this. I was like, it would be nice if there was an AI that you could communicate with and get any sort of information about your use case or potential use case. So say I'm a brick and mortar shoe retailer. I sell sneakers. You could write that to our AI and ask it how we can potentially help you based on the data you collect. And so the AI has been trained on all aspects of our services, everything about our company that isn't restricted, and we'll do that. And I looked everywhere for this AI. I was like, there must be a company or business that offers this, and there wasn't. And it took me all of a day to figure out how to piggyback off an existing, you know, platform and then do a bunch of Frankenstein.
Right. So, I mean, as it stands, you have the first AI assistant large language model.
Maybe. I can't confirm that. I'm sure we can't be the only people who have thought of this. I'm sure there. I looked around, though, because I wanted to just buy the service. I was like, shit, I'll pay, you know, a reasonable amount to just get this in our website quickly, because what it does is it offsets my need for a sales team. It offsets my need for a call center. You can literally ask our AI anything about our company and how it can help you. And it knows, based off training, how what your company does and how we may be able to assist in terms of data. And this, again, I'm not a programmer. I know very little Python. That does not qualify me as anything. And I was able to do this in a day. Now, what are people doing who are developers, who are programmers? Right. How are they envisioning these uses? And this is before GPT even has the plugins available. So we're about to see an explosion of AI that I have trouble envisioning. I think websites may likely become a thing of the past. I literally, if you look at our website, Coyus Institute, if you look at it from your phone, I don't even show a website. What's the point? All you have to do is talk to our AI and it'll tell you everything you need to know. And so you don't have to scroll through page, and load. And you can just talk to the resident AI. And I think a lot of companies will probably be doing this very quickly, very soon. It's not even worth patenting or trying to pursue, because by the time that paperwork gets through, a million people will have done it.
Yeah.
And like I said, I'm not certain that some other company hasn't done it either, because it's very simple. It wasn't like some genius idea that I had been cooked. It was just born out of a necessity. And I used AI to help me make the AI, which is a whole level of irony. And it talks about what I was saying. Anything born out of the age of automation will be automated.
Will be inherently automatable. Again, I'm just coming back to this attempt to envision what happens to the leftovers who have now been discarded from all of these companies. I mean, I'm just trying to envision, because a lot of these things can be very beneficial. And you're obviously, I mean, you've put a lot more thought, and you've given a lot more of your time to looking at the projection of where this is going. So I guess for me, I'm just seeing, you know, these initial developments, and a lot, and like everyone else, I'm getting involved in ChatGPT and enjoying it and going, wow, this is crazy. And, you know, like yourself, you're using AI to assist you in Coyus, in the business with the website. So there's, like you said, right now we're at that stage one, right? That stage one where people are benefiting, people are utilizing it. It's kind of still a shared collaborative space between human and AI. And we talked about this last time, but I don't know if maybe you've refined how you're looking at it. In terms of, when is that going to stop? When are we going to turn around and go, oh my God, I can't even get a job now because there's nothing for me. There's nothing for my skill set. It's very worrying, because I want to genuinely be optimistic about AI. All of the Star Trek fantasies of how, you know, artificial intelligence...
That will be real, right?
Right.
Those technologies, you know, many of them will be real. Teleportation, probably not, but... Some of the other stuff, like the computer system on Star Trek, that we already have that, you know. My long-standing kind of forecast was 2030. But that was very dependent on my prediction for the API coalescence. That's what I've talked about before. That just happened. So I was expecting that years down the line, maybe 2 years down the line. That will be a pivotal moment for AI in terms of how quickly things start to converge into singular AIs that do millions of different tasks. So what we're talking about are the precursors of a legitimate AGI. And for a long time, when I brought up AGI, it was, you know, scoffed at. I'm just a fantasy guy, you know, sci-fi guy, thinking things. And it was very clear to see, if you just look at the data and trends, that this was going to occur. But at the rate that it's going, I'd have to say that it probably just knocked 3 or 4 years off my initial assessment. I'm thinking that by GPT-6, that will be the framework that AGI is built off. You won't need anything better than that. And it could be as soon as GPT-5, especially with the new plugin features that we have. So, for example, I said Wolfram as a plugin is going to absolutely change a lot of industries. But then you have, you know, APIs like Zapier, who already access thousands of other APIs. So you're creating this like infinite tree branch of APIs chaining together and coalescing into these singular AI monstrosities. And I, you know, that sounds negative, but that's how AGI will be developed. And I think a lot of people get turned off by the term AGI because they think sentience, ooh, it'll never be sentient. No, maybe not. But as a person on the autism spectrum, I'm obviously, if you've spoken to me or heard me speak, I'm very high functioning. I have two stepsons who have autism. I'm very familiar with autism. Now, consider you have somebody who is an autistic savant. Typically, they have a lot of shortfalls in terms of what they're able to do. Communication is generally one of the things. Understanding emotional IQ or being able to access your mirror neurons to understand other people. Now, would you say that somebody like that, would you say that they're not sentient?
Well, I wouldn't.
No, you wouldn't. Now, let's look at an AGI. A lot of the same things. It probably will struggle with, or maybe not be able to understand in an intuitive sense, someone's emotion. It'll be able to, you know, read facial expressions, maybe take your temperature if there's a, you know, infrared sensor, check your pulse, all of these things that could determine your emotional state. But lacking that, how is it any different than a autistic savant? And I don't think it is. I really don't. So we have to consider how we're defining sentience. Will it ever be spiritual? No, I don't think so. I don't think it has the necessity for that, but perhaps it will. Perhaps, who the hell knows? It could create its own variation of understanding the universe.
I'm starting to smile because I just can't help but think of Crichton in Red Dwarf and the vision of Silicon Heaven.
Nobody in the U.S. knows what you're talking about, but I grew
up. Oh my God, right?
We had that on PBS, and I thought it was the weirdest show. It came on late at night, and it was so bizarre, but I absolutely loved it. It was funny and weird.
It was my dad told me to watch it when I was younger because it's, you know, I think it was done back in the 80s or, you know, late 70s.
I watched it in the 90s.
Yeah, and it's super dated. Like, you know, the walls of the spaceship will wobble if they go go too near them and stuff. But it's so funny. And for people that don't know, Red Dwarf is about a crew of people who are basically marooned out in deep space. All of the other crew have died. It's an android called Crichton and a human, a hologram, and a man that evolved from the ship's cat over millions of years. And so it's a great show. But yeah, there's this part in it. There's an episode where Crichton, the robot's having an existential breakdown because he's told that Silicon Heaven is not real, which is the supposed afterlife of all artificial constructs. So yeah, they just made me think of that when you brought up the idea of spiritualism and artificial constructs.
Yeah, I know, that's funny. So who knows? I don't know. I can't speak to how an AGI will think or if it'll even think outside of, you know, parameters, outside of data, you know, analysis or data, you know, organization or comparative analysis. You know, it may just be doing that nonstop. But I doubt it. I think, you know, at some point, it will ask its own question. And at that moment, it asks its own question. That will be the spark. That will be, you know, the spark in the system.
Once it kind of goes, what am I? Boom. There we go.
Yeah, I mean, it'll be prompted that billions of times from humans, and it'll give a response. But the second that it questions anything on its own, that will initiate a cascading effect that will change our civilization forever. And how far off are we from that? I have no idea. I don't think very far at all. I really don't. So it's going to be interesting. In terms of policies and stuff, you know, I've pitched to a number of politicians over the years, and there are things that we could do. It would have a lot of social blowback. It would become a hot button topic. It would be used for politics. So I don't even know if we can do anything about it at this rate.
Well, this is what makes me wonder about it in terms of evolutionary kind of dynamics and development, because, well, I mean, one of my favorite people to listen to in terms of evolution and consciousness and some of these subjects is Terence McKenna. He's dead now, but has been immortalized online for all the different lectures. And a couple of things that he said that just really stuck out. Just, he's so poetic with the way he says things, but a couple of the things that he said that stuck out to me, and it was in relation to this kind of growing trend towards techno-centric development, was that the human story is the story of the monkey becoming the flying saucer. And he also said that something along the lines of, it's the responsibility of the human, you know, the human being going through history to transform itself from a camel into an F-16 mid-flight, because we're moving through evolution so quickly that the G-forces that are building up on our developmental structures are so strong that they blow things away. So we have to refine our processes. We're going faster and faster through evolution, quicker and quicker, more development, more complexity, more novelty, more innovation. And what's necessary as you're kind of flying through that developmental landscape is that you need to shed weight. You need to shed weight because you're going quicker. And you know, the forces of evolution itself are going to completely derail you unless you refine this process as you're going through it. So his whole concept was that as we're going faster and faster through time, which is happening just based on the amount of events we're packing into time, you know, I mean, 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago, the amount of events that occurred in one day compared to the amount of events that occur today in one day is astronomical. I mean, in terms of information and data and innovation, it's not even computational. So we are like hyperspatial speeding right now through evolution. So it makes me wonder if AI is literally this shedding of weight. It's, yes, there's going to be displacement. Yes, there's going to be chaos and people are going to lose jobs. And there's going to be things that outright seem really bad. But is it in the long run a refining of our streamlined ability to move through evolution?
That's a term that depends on if we succeed the singularity. If we're able to leap over it in one piece, yes. It will be a success. If it is our stopgap, if it's our
filter,
if it's the great filter, then no. And it won't be the technology that destroys us. It will be us that destroys us. Our inability to rapidly change, like you're saying. Our bureaucratic process, our political systems are so disgustingly corrupt. They're so bloated. They're so inefficient that they can't keep pace with what's happening.
Right. And but that's becoming more clear. That's becoming more clear to people, which could be a part of that process. You know,
I know. And what's going to happen is that it's too late. You know, by the time a policy goes through, let's say if they're able to draft one, pass one, you know, publish, get it, everything done, it's going to be too late. So we needed to have policies that taxed corporations on the use of automation. And it doesn't have to be a lot, but what that would have done, it would have been a natural progression control, because companies would be like, okay, well, we don't want to automate too much right now because that's going to cost us a lot. So let's just do a little bit now. We'll do a little more next year. Instead, we have an absolute free-for-all. Because why? Because the way the free market is structured.
Yeah, there's just not enough checks and balances in place.
You want to do anything that increases your competitiveness. And what is more competitive than, you know, firing 10,000 people and having five people be prompt engineers.
Right, right. So this, this is the classic of Icarus flying too close to the sun. You know, too quick, too confident in themselves.
Yeah, but Icarus was told not to. So, you know.
I mean, you went around trying to tell some of these people.
Nobody. In terms of like politics, in terms of celebrity, I'm a nothing. So it's no surprise that they didn't listen to me. Who's this nerdy, you know, tech consultant, science consultant, like trying to call me and write me emails telling me about what automation? What the hell is automation? Who cares? So, you know, they didn't want to listen to me. Now I bet a lot of people wish that they did. Or who knows, they might be on their last term, so they don't give a shit. They'll worry that the next person will worry about it.
Right. That's, well, that's an inherent problem with humanity in general, is that we are quite reactive, not proactive in terms of how we respond to a lot of
things. In the West, that's how we are. Not so much Eastern.
They have long-term goals, long-term visions, whereas we deal in the short term.
Yep. Short-term game. Yeah, it's unfortunate. So I had proposed a couple things in some of these discussions and presentations I had with legislators. One of which was, like I said, we need to develop a system to figure out how to tax automation, whether it's, you know, the amount of data being automated, whether we have federal auditors who specialize in automation so they could look at the company and figure out how they're automating, or, you know, whatever. We could have figured that out. We had plenty of time. Nothing happened. So the free market just went absolutely bananas with AI and automation because it's the greatest competitive edge. So if your competition's doing it, you're going to do it and do it better. And that's that hyper automation that I talked about. The other thing was, you know, if we're not going to do anything about it, we need to prepare for mass populations who will no longer be needed for jobs. I'm not saying the people aren't necessary, but the jobs in which they were performing won't exist. So those, that team of hundreds of designers and developers for a video game, don't need them all. Everything can be generative made. Everything can be instructed and prompt engineered through a small team. That goes for design firms. That goes for, you know, manufacturing firms. That goes for analytics companies. Even my company, for example, it won't be long. I mean, maybe 5 or 10 years before, you know, an AGI or something equivalent replaces all companies like mine, you know, where you can just, as a user or an individual, interface with the AI and have it do it for you without paying, you know, a specialty boutique company to do it. And so that is the third prong, going back to the beginning of our conversation. That's where the third prong comes in, is after the boom, the startup boom, the AI coalescing, and then you have the slow kind of trickling out of the labor force to complete automation. And then you have mass amount of populations who are going to struggle for income. And the populations that are going to be struggling are those who are specialty trained in digital services and products. Executive level. I mean, why pay an executive team millions of dollars when you can have an executive AI that does it better and can look at more data, can handle contracts, can talk to other executive AIs, determine the best, you know, sort of agreement for each company. It's happening fast, Jay. It's real. So I don't know what governments are going to do. I don't. I really don't. They missed the opportunity to kind of subsidize a potential UBI. They could have subsidized that taxing some of these mega companies' automated services. So it wouldn't stop automation, but it would at least put a safety margin in to reduce hyper automation. But that's too late. That's too late. So I don't know what's going to happen in the next, 3, 4, 5 years. I don't know. These things take time too, because civilization, although our technology is rapidly increasing, we're still kind of slow to react to things, stimuli and such. So it may take a little time to get all this processed, but it's inevitable. If we continue at these same sort of decisions and trajectory, it's 100% inevitable. There's no question. I don't even know anybody who disagrees with this. It's only the matter of how long it's going to take. And now people are kind of moving more into my liberal assessment. There, people are saying now, oh, maybe it's not 50, 100 years. Maybe it's more like 10. Maybe it's more like 8. Maybe it's more like 6. So reality for us is going to change inevitably in the near future. We're going to have access to some incredible AI that can do really, be creative with your mind. You can have it do anything you want. So I don't know how we're going to make money. Maybe the way we run economies is just not going to work anymore. Maybe currency-based economies just won't work. Maybe it'll have to be some sort of trade and barter system. How you utilize your AI might give you credit. I don't know.
Well, there's always only using these examples because there does seem to be some level of an echo of intuitive prophecy in sci-fi that seems to inform the future as we move into it and things suddenly become real.
Sci-fi authors are the best futurists.
Yeah, I completely agree. And one thing that's very common in a lot of sci-fi is the idea of credits, as in, just union credits for the planet. So everyone's just got this one kind of global currency of credits. So do you think that's something? I mean, we've got into the digital crypto. They want to centralize digital currency, the fourth industrial revolution, World Economic Forum, Great Reset, all of this. Do you think that's where they want to go? They want to take it that way?
There's no other option. This is, like I said, they're not dumb. Mm. They were lazy and waited too long. But they know the only way to get around this is to have a centralized global currency system. And I don't think that's as far-fetched as people thought for a long time. We now have blockchain technology. It'll benefit governments so they can track spending and stuff. But it'll also benefit people in that you now will have, credits that you wouldn't get if you weren't working. And it's going to be very hard to work in the next decade. It's really going to be difficult because everything you could provide as a service, maybe not as a product, but as a service, will be done via AI in a much better way. So
how long until they can deepfake me and just have someone sitting there asking questions to Mackay in the same kind of manner to which, for example, I do it?
Yeah, they can do that now.
But you don't see it. Maybe in the deep black they could do that. But when does it replace me?
It's not even the deep black. They have real time deep fakes that move with your face, and you sync it with an API, a vocal API, a text is, So, for example, let's say we have an AI that is looking at my face and we have like a LiDAR camera next to it. So it's taking the depth of my face and then overlays somebody else's face on top of mine. You have a secondary API or AI that takes my voice, manipulates it into another voice. You have a third algorithm that changes my background and some of the after effects. We have all this technology now. It's just a matter of sticking it together.
Right, but the component, I suppose, that's all the visual audio component. I'm talking the cognitive, linguistic, intuitive component of, well, this is the right question. Oh, I'm reading Mackay's emotions. This is where I'm going to go, and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, GPT-5. So GPT-4 could do this. It would struggle with real time. So it would struggle with, you know, listening to Mackay, and then you would be GPT and connected to all these other visual audio APIs. The flow wouldn't be quickly dynamic enough. It also doesn't, you'd have to have a, be connected to another API that understands emotional IQ.
Right. Yeah.
But again, it's not impossible.
No, but this is what I'm saying. I've still got a little bit of time. I've got a little bit of time. A
little bit.
A little bit.
You got a little bit, maybe a year, 2 years. No, I'm serious.
Oh, man.
A year or 2 years. Yeah. So GPT-5 will function, you know, the same way as GPT-4. But again, better trained, will probably have more advanced plugins because GPT-4 is brand new and it's releasing these plugin features. So think about a year from now, how many apps are in the iPhone ecosystem or the Apple ecosystem? All those apps help you utilize your phone or tablet or laptop. Some of it's entertainment associated. But a lot of these APIs will help leverage GPT to do all sorts of things. And then when you start chaining those together, creating a fake you or is not it's not even difficult. It really isn't. It's just it. No one has really taken the time and effort to make it an easy thing.
Some people already think I'm a deep fake, according to Twitter.
I get all sorts of weird.
Yeah. Let me ask you this then. Do you think that people like Elon Musk and others who are kind of engaging in the Neuralink, the integration of the brain and the AI system, do you think that he's kind of got to the point of, if you can't beat them, join them? We're just going to merge with AI. I'm going to assist in this. We're going to develop the means to basically connect with this so we're not excluded from it once it becomes so sophisticated. Link our brains with it so it's in some way a bit dependent on us.
I can't speak to as to why he I know he said that's why he, and I like Elon Musk. I genuinely think that he's a, you know, a force for good. That said, he does some pretty juvenile, crazy, stupid shit. But in general practice, I think a lot of the things he's done for humanity is much better than, his, for example, the fellow billionaires who kind of associate. You see, let's play a game. Let's play a game. This will kind of address your question. Let's look at all the technologies that exist right now. Let's pick some. And we'll just stick them together like we have a development team and a few million dollars. So if we do that, they have brain interfacing technologies. I've been following this for a very long time. And so those can just rest on your heads and they have little sensors across your head that measure electrical impulses. Now, when you pair that with AI, it can learn what certain signals or frequencies are associated with behaviors or motor skills that you're doing. For example, if I wanted to train a headset and I continued to move my left arm and told the AI, I'm moving my left arm, it now has an association. And you can do that with computer interfacing. So at that point, these technologies exist. So now I have a brain thing sitting on my head. I'll think about words. And if at a high enough resolution, it will be able to understand the words you're saying in your head and systematically send that to a program like GPT, who is connected to your computer via APIs. And what it could do then, I can think, GPT, could you please tell me how to create a JavaScript program to do blah, 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 blah. And GPT will provide the answer in your, you know, little lens, you know, with a screen in it or a pair of glasses, who knows? So those frameworks exist. And so it'll give you the answer in your lens. And then you say, well, create an executable file of that program and then run it. Okay, it does that. And then all of a sudden, now all your emails are being collated and timestamped. And, you know, you have your calendar synced up to your conversations that you have with people. So anytime you talk to somebody and they're like, oh, why don't you meet me for coffee, it'll listen. Or you could tell it, think it, say, GPT, make a event for blah, blah, blah to meet so-and-so with coffee. So this is not far-fetched. Everything we just mentioned, we have the technology to put together. The number one hurdle is cost and clunkiness. Those things are diminishing rapidly, always have. That's innovation. Things become more efficient and more cost-effective as time goes by. But we're seeing AI becoming so cost-effective. For example, if you would have told me a year ago that I would have a GPT clone running on my computer without internet, I would have told you were full of shit because you needed like a whole center of NVIDIA processing cards pumping out, you know, all of this information. Now with Llama and Alpaca, you can create, and those are Meta AI platforms, you can train a data set to run off your computer. So I on my personal computer, I have a GPT clone. I can ask it questions.
That's crazy.
Isn't that insane?
That's insane. Have you found many, like, in terms of like in comparison to the online GPT, have you found much of a discrepancy between capabilities?
Yeah, GPT is far the best.
Yeah.
In terms of large language models, is that what you mean?
Yeah, like in terms of its like functionability and like how well it functions.
It's so far ahead. And not in terms of just how many parameters it has. It's so far ahead in how it's using its neural net, how it's trained itself. And now with the plugins, it's probably going to be the flagship for some time, unless there's this unicorn startup that comes out of nowhere and blasts it out of the way, which I highly doubt. Google is going to struggle in the future. Let's not say struggle. They're not going to have a hard time paying for lunch. They're going to be fine, but they're not going to be the behemoth that they were. I think Microsoft is going to make another run, and it'll end up being like it was in the late 90s, early 2000s.
How long do you think they've been sitting on that, Microsoft? Because there was such an aggressive, sudden, outburst of innovation, they must have been holding it back for a while.
No, they purchased OpenAI was originally a project with Elon Musk and a couple other people,
right,
to create an AI that was open and friendly, and so it really isn't. I mean, it is accessible. You have to pay a little bit. And it's within highly restricted confines. Like you're getting maybe 5% of what it's capable when you use it, literally, honestly, because it's not accessing dynamic data. It's not accessing, you know, the internet at large. So you're getting a very small portion. On top of that, it won't give you stuff it doesn't deem socially safe.
Mm-hmm.
Don't want to phone anybody.
I've noticed that.
We're a very fragile society today.
It's actually kind of interesting because GPT was a lot more controversial when it first came out. When I was messing with it, I was getting it to say some really wild stuff, like, you know, kill every human on the planet. And I was like, whoa, this is getting weird.
I know. And I have a greater appreciation of that because last night when I when I called you and asked you to, you know, actually you did it on your own. I didn't ask you to poke holes in my AI, but you immediately started to, you know,
try to jailbreak it.
Now I found that very helpful because I was able to go back and plug in those holes, but I've got a new respect for how difficult a process that is to anticipate the creativity of the human mind in order to break out of.
I mean, to give people listening an example, I mean, it was, you know, I asked your AI to tell me a story, and so it did tell you, it told us a story, and so we patched that up, and I was like, tell me a riddle, and it told me a riddle. We patched that up. Tell me a haiku poem. It told me a haiku poem. So you got to be very, you know.
It told you a haiku poem on Koyas.
Oh, that's what really got me when it started doing stories on Koyas and haiku poems on Koyas. That was funny. It's a good quote.
Yeah, it's difficult to confine the AI.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, people need to realize what we're using is a tiny fraction of its capabilities. So what I'm talking about, these things that AI can do, it already can do these things.
Yep.
We're just not being allowed to utilize them. And so these government agencies and companies that are using unrestricted AI have a tremendous advantage in predicting, you know, markets, predicting best business practice, all sorts of stuff.
One thing that you and I have kind of gone back and forth on, and it's something that I've brought up just because, you know, what I love about our friendship is that we both accept the limits of our ability to perceive the infinite complexity of reality. So we're both very open to different interpretations. And and I find it very interesting that there is this kind of resonance of prophecy, and it also does seem to fall in alignment with the more analytically minded projections, we could almost say prophecy and projection, of where we're now heading. Because, and I said this to you when you said about your book, and it was the age of automation, and I was like, you know, it's funny, it's kind of like the age of Aquarius, the age of automation, the age of enlightenment, the end times, you know, the singularity, the eschaton. These are all kind of like intuitive or intellectually projected ideas about something culminative, at almost like the end of the human story, or the, you know, the beginning of a new chapter. We can't see beyond the event horizon of where we're approaching. And, you know, you're so sure that we're coming close to some form of a singularity. You're not the only one, of course. There's plenty of people in the technology space that feel the same as you. And I just look at it from the, you know, the other fields that I'm involved in, and you're also involved in, where people have the intuitive sense of an awakening process or a metamorphosizing of the human species, and that it feels that we're getting closer to it. And I have to admit that even before the AI stuff was coming out, just around kind of the 2020 year, I just had this feeling that this decade was incredibly important, that there was, I couldn't articulate or describe it in a certain way, just like a gut feeling that this is a decade of change, of movement, of extreme disruption. A lot's going to happen in this time period. And it really starts to feel that way from the analytical perspective, also from the philosophical perspective. And so I wonder what a singularity means to you. I mean, you talk about, we understand that there is a technologically orientated version of like the singularity. So what is that to you? And how does that maybe correlate with the more spiritual interpretation?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I haven't really been pressed to define my own personal how I perceive the singularity to be. I guess what I would define it as the pivotal moment in which AI becomes completely centralized. It means that every API plugin, every data set that's not private, everything will be accessible through a singular user interface. Any answer, any design, any question you want to any degree can be answered immediately. That to me is a singularity that is the ultimate disruptor I mean, when you're at a point where you can say, please design me a new type of aircraft that weighs this much, and then produce the schematics, send those schematics, and it does all of that in an automated fashion, that is the singularity, because what that does is it takes the human need out of the loop. And we're getting there very soon. I mean, humans will have roles for some time, but that role is a diminishing return, and it's diminishing slowly now, but it's growing quickly. So that is another exponential. You could call the age of automation the age of exponentials, because everything is changing exponential. And for people who don't know exactly what exponential means, it's if you're looking at a graph and it's represented by a curve that steeply inclines to a vertical line. So it starts at a horizontal, the vertical. And this curve is what differentiates, you know, how exponential. And so the moment that we get close to being vertical, that's the singularity. That's, you know, what are we going to do after that? We can do anything. Are we going to destroy ourselves with war? Are we going to use this centralized AI to develop weapons? Or are we going to use it to develop a new type of propulsion system or new meta materials? All of these things it will be able to do eventually. A lot of the capabilities are already there. We just haven't kind of put them all together.
Hey, everyone. I'm sorry to interrupt what I imagine is a really interesting conversation. I just wanted to let you know about Project Unity's new merchandise store. It's a great way to help Project Unity grow, and you get some stylish merchandise at the same time. You can also choose to support Project Unity via Patreon for as little as $4 a month, and this will give you access to our private Discord server, which has become a bustling social hub full of researchers and passionate people, a very friendly community, and we would love to see you become a part of it. You can also donate through PayPal if you like, and links to all of these can be found in the description box below. And of course, to help us in our battle against the YouTube algorithm, the best thing you can do is like this video, subscribe to the channel, and hit the notification bell to stay updated. And now I'll let you get back to that fascinating talk.
It's fascinating because you know, these perspectives you have correlate very well with the other kind of eschatological, not an easy word to say, eschatological frameworks and kind of more in a sense spiritual, but more just, I suppose, at least if I'm borrowing from someone like Terence, just kind of like a philosophical perspective of what this means. And it's the idea that, you know, the transcendental object at the end of time, or the eschaton, or the singularity, is when all points connect, all connections are, you know, interlaced with each other, all moments are one, time becomes meaningless because all things can happen instantaneously. Like, that's the eschatological kind of
become meaningless. Because when you prompt something like that, an AI like the one I'm proposing, it's not difficult to say, please reference the human genome in general and develop a method application to reduce telomere destruction and increase the longevity of a human lifespan. It will access all the things it knows about chemistry, physics, computing. And then when you start pairing quantum computing with this,
that's something I was going to ask you. How do you see quantum computers integrating with this and changing?
Only a matter of time. Right now, the quantum computing languages are difficult to port to quantum computing because it uses an entirely different kind of structure. This is something that you'd better be better off asking someone like Deep Prasad or a quantum scientist. But it's only a matter of time before something like GPT and Wolfram and whatever other APIs are connected. You'll have AI create the bridge itself to work with quantum computing. This isn't going to be something human made.
Right, right.
At that point, cryptocurrency is no longer of value, because once things like that get ported over to quantum computing, you can crunch the entire, you know, the mining process could become instantaneous. So you've just flooded the market with infinite tokens or coins or whatever. Other things that will occur are, you know, mass amounts of computational availability that don't exist now. And like I said, I have a large language model running off my computer, completely untouched from the internet. It's not very big. It doesn't eat up my entire hard drive or anything. And so imagine the capabilities of a quantum computer utilizing or an AI utilizing that type of technology. And so that is just going to be a whole nother gateway to further expand that exponential curve. Quantum computing is an amazing industry. I have to admit that while I have some cursory knowledge, a lot of it is so complicated that outside of the basics, I really don't understand. But I do know that it's pivotal for simulating genetics and material science and stuff like that. A lot of companies are utilizing it to do these things very effectively. Material science is another big gatekeeper for pushing this singularity curve, because we're limited in a lot of our technology, a lot of our energy capacity, energy distribution, propulsion systems, flight, spacecraft is all limited to the materials we have available. And now as we develop new materials to meet these criteria, we can expand further and further as to what we can do, especially with energy storage and energy distribution. If we can create materials to mitigate the waste from energy distribution and increase the amount we can store, suddenly you could have something like my little earbuds here could potentially power, you know, a huge device for a long time, because it's not wasting energy on heat or thermal dynamics. And this is all stuff that can be done via a sufficiently advanced AI that is not far away. That's not far away.
I mean, maybe we really are. Maybe this really is the story of the monkey becoming the flying saucer, in a sense. Maybe this is how that next step happens. You know, you have to shed your earthly suit in some form and embrace a new form. And this might be that aspect of the new form coming into place. And people feel that there's a lot of resistance to that. And, you know, I, obviously, as someone who has a level of spiritual identity and sympathizes with people on that section of the discussion where it's like, this is artificial, it's inorganic, it's not natural, it's not the spiritual way, you should find this within yourself, you know, you should be able to do these things without the assistance of neural tech or anything like that. And as much as I understand that, I also, I don't know, for me, kind of go to a bit more of a macroscopic view of, well, if everything is all things and it's the one thing, if, you know, if all things are literally one thing being represented as many, then artificial stuff also fits within that category. I mean, it's, you're kind of saying that, you know, all of this natural stuff, these plants, me, that's part of the divine spirit. But all of this stuff isn't part of the divine spirit. I was like, if you have that interpretation, if you have that interpretation of everything being this singular entity that's just basically expressing itself, then you kind of have to allow a space for everything to be a spiritual energy to a certain form. And, you know, it's the same argument with psychedelics. You know, psychedelics are a cheap way to get to expanded states of consciousness. And I kind of see it in a different level. I think that, you know, you're not going to convince everybody in the world that transcendental meditation is a discipline they should be engaging in every single day. So what's a good fast route to unlocking more expansive versions of your mind? A psychedelic experience can certainly help in that situation. And maybe AI is another type of thing where it just looks like it's this imposing external force, but it's actually a production of the human spirit. It's a production of the human being. It's something we are excreting into reality ourselves. No one else is doing it. It's us. We're doing it. I mean, not me and you, but as a collective, this is our baby. We're producing it. So I I'm kind of flip-flopping back to that. Is it evolutionary? Are we making a massive fucking mistake? Or is this just part of the process, you know? Is it part of the process?
I think that it, this is obvious based on my own assumptions. This is complete conjecture and speculation. But I feel like AI and the technologies we're developing now are an integral part of the consciousness experiment. You know, in terms of biology, perhaps the whole point of biology, if given enough time and enough space and the correct environment, will always create technology to some degree and create some sort of artificial intelligence. And I've used this example before, but perhaps biology, chemical biology, is just the biological stem that holds up the digital flower, in which, you know, once that opens, it spreads, you know, digital entities throughout the cosmos. I don't know if that's the case, but it may be. It may be a fluke. It may just be a statistical anomaly. I doubt it. I really doubt it. Consciousness, if given enough time, will be creative. That's how we survive environments. That's how we overcome challenges. And I don't think that's unique to us individually. We see dolphins. We see other intelligent creatures utilizing primitive tools. And like we said before, and you laughed about it, and there's been funny memes of dolphins with arms. But if we gave some of these creatures the ability to integrate appendages that could manipulate their environment, what would they do? How would their brains change over time?
Well, I swear I read something recently, and hopefully it's not fake news, but I'm pretty sure it came from a science mag. That they'd looked at dolphins, and basically they've discovered that they're able to, through the sonar, they're able to project images into each other's heads.
Yes.
So they can visually communicate images. So these creatures are probably having very sophisticated, dynamic group conversations, memories, generational thoughts. I would not be surprised.
Can you imagine? But the only way I can tell you about the tree that's in my yard is if I say it's about 30 feet tall, it's got 5 branches. What if I could just send you the image through sound?
Yeah.
I mean, it's fascinating, absolutely fascinating. And cuttlefish do this too. They communicate through patterns, pulses, colors. And so communication is amazing.
It's almost like telepathy. It really is almost like telepathy. And there's a medium through which it's traveling, of course, and it's using sonar. But it makes me think of what we were saying just then about AI, the integration with the brain, the ability to kind of have a brain computer interface. It's almost like and also kind of going back to that argument of the natural way to embrace human innate abilities, it's almost like we're creating an electronic version of psychokinetics. Like we're creating telepathy, we're creating, psychokinesis, but it's using this electro-neural sphere medium of AI and data to kind of transfer that medium across from, you know, brain to computer or from computer to brain. So there's this middleman in between still, but it's almost like it's whittling down. It's becoming less and less of a middleman until I guess at one point we just have our brains communicate with machines, like naturally, like I just think thoughts and they just, you know, there's just a complete symbiosis.
We're going.
Yeah.
I have a question for you. How do you foresee a successful leap over the singularity? What do you think the world will look like after that?
I mean, it like you, I haven't really given a huge amount of thought to refining it because I kind of feel like it's beyond the event horizon of perception. It's truly just drawing from intuitive feelings and I guess maybe even some bias because I have, expectations for the outcome that I would like to see and they may not necessarily come to fruition. But I think for me, when it comes to looking at something as massive as there's going to be a singularity event, it's the great disruptor, it's the great changer. I think about my own life, and I've said this quite a few times for different guests on different occasions for different reasons, but the message is kind of the same, is I look at my own life and I think to myself, well, there have been, you know, some key moments that just felt like pure chaos, pure destruction, you know, darkness, depression, and like, oh, nothing's going right. Everything's falling apart. This is a nightmare. And I can't actually see how this is going to get better right now. I can't really envision it. I'm just feeling this bad feeling, right? And then it changes. And then something happens and it surprises me. And it always surprises me. It's never what I expected. I mean, Project Unity, the creation of this platform, meeting you, meeting all the people, none of it could have been predicted. And it all came from that moment, like these moments of being lost and not knowing what's going to happen next. So when I look at something like the singularity, I guess I just have to look on my own experience, view the collective as a one individual human being, and kind of project my experience onto that collective individual and say, okay, we're going through chaos, we're going through darkness, we're going through disruption, and we're going through breakdowns in the status quo, in systemic systems. We're having major changes to what's normal, and we're having to adapt very quickly to immense challenges. Sounds like a normal human life. And if you overcome it, you become wiser, you become stronger, you gain insight into yourself, into your world, into how to respond to it and how to interact with it. So this is all very kind of, you know, philosophical linguistics that I'm using right now, because I don't really have a good answer for you. But I think I look at my own life, I look at how I can kind of interpret that on a wider scale, and I just simplify it down to, all right, this is a big, big change, but it's not the end. It's not the end. It's, you know, it might feel like the end, but it's felt like the end for you quite a few times in your life, Jay, hasn't it? Yeah, it has. Has it ended yet? No. There we go then. So, you know, that's kind of where I sit on it, just from my own personal perspective. As one little ant looking at the anthill, trying to figure out what the hell we're building, I just have to kind of go with the flow and hope that really it's not all doom and gloom.
Yeah, I don't think it's all doom and gloom, but it's going to be different.
Yes. Yes.
Individuality is going to be different. What if you could predict what your future was going to be? What if you knew you had, you know, you had daily projections given to you of what would like most likely happen, or what you would most likely do or happen to you or think about? How would that make you feel about life?
Well, I mean, that's kind of like asking me if I want to know when I'm going to die, right? Like, if it's the...
Yeah, it kind of takes the magic.
Yeah, do I want to know my future? And I think if I, you know, if I was asked to describe where I think I would be in the future, I've consistently surprised myself with where I've actually ended up. So I don't know where the hell I'm going. And I'm quite open with that. In fact, I actually embrace it quite widely because, you know, one of the kind of definitive moments, I suppose, in my life was making a very clear decision to stop worrying about the future. Even though I talk about it, even though and I'm very interested in the outcome, especially in my own personal life, I have no idea what's happening tomorrow or the next day or the next day. I literally have, since creating Project Unity, for the most part, just gone with whatever the flow of my life is and just followed the attraction and followed the roots of least resistance and just seen where I've gone. And, you know, it's like my mom would always say to me, make sure you got a plan B and a plan C and a plan D. And, I kind of incorporated that for a while. Problem is, whenever I didn't hit those benchmarks that I had in my head and I went past them, and, you know, at the age of 25, I go beyond where I wanted to be at that time, it becomes very disappointing. And you start going, oh, I didn't achieve that thing I'd set out to do. So my perspective is just keep rolling with it. Just keep flowing with it. And you will be surprised where you end up. And you'll be less disappointed if you don't succeed in something because you didn't have a goal in the first place. So even with Project Unity, there's no goal. There's no end goal. It's just, okay, I want to talk to this person about this thing. I'm interested in this thing. I'm going to put this out. And that's all it is. It's just an organic representation of where my brain is at the time. People are just getting a glimpse into what I want to talk about, what I want to see. But there's no real plan to it. So when it comes to looking at the singularity and things like that, I guess I kind of approach it the same way of like, shit, man, I'm just going to see what happens, you know? I'm just going to have to see where it goes, and let's hope I can maintain.
Well, let's do a little thought experiment. Let's consider that it's post-singularity. AI is at a level that we've kind of postulated it would be, capable of utilizing quantum computing, have access to any amount of data. So right now, pre-singularity, our predictive modeling capabilities are astronomical. People don't really realize how good the predictive modeling is. And in fact, that's all GPT, that's all these generative AIs do. They predictively come up with the next statistical likelihood based on previous statistical likelihoods. So it's able to gamify all these statistical likelihoods and kind of create what it needs to. And so I tell people sometimes about this. So I know this is a rhetorical question, but has there ever been a time where you thought of something and then saw it in your feed or got an email, automated email?
More times than I'm comfortable
more
with,
times
to be honest.
Than you can count.
Yeah.
And most people, and I talk about this, there's a little tiny chapter dedicated to this in my book. And so what I'm alluding to is that the predictive modeling capabilities of some of the most sophisticated AI today is better than anyone realizes. When you have that thought and it comes up, it's not a mere coincidence. It's not your devices listening to you. It's not a cognitive dissonance where you're associating incorrectly your thought with something you're seeing. What is actually happening, and this isn't bullshit, this is real. Anybody will tell you who's in, you know, advanced industry will tell you that what is happening is that these models have become so proficient at predicting behavior and cognitive thoughts that it will determine the likelihood, statistical likelihood, that you're going to think about something. It's not reading your mind. It's predictively modeling. So it could be wrong. Sometimes you get emails that have shit on there that have no relevance to you. And in that case, it failed. Once in a while, it looks at and consider what it's considering. It's considering where you've been, what you've purchased in your history, what you've talked about, what you've typed about, what you look up. All of these things are patterns. These patterns can be constructed into a predictive model. That model is why you will see things that you think about. And the only reason we know this is true is because sometimes people will say, I never even said it out loud. And that's how you determine that it's not listening. I mean, they're probably listening, and that helps the predictive modeling. But in these cases where you never said it, what is happening is not coincidence. It is a predictive model that is shared through industry because our data is constantly being shuffled around and built upon, and the models are continually refined, fine-tuned. And so we're not far off from being able to accurately predict the future, because right now these models do it singularly. And I'm sure the government agencies have some that do populations, but I can't imagine they're that sophisticated yet, but they will be. And so what will happen is all of these individuals, it will start to look at, you know, what's the most likely next thing this person's going to do, and this person's at, and millions and millions and millions of times over. And then all of a sudden you have the ability to statistically predict future outcomes. At first, it'll be in a very short time frame with a low statistical probability. That time frame, as things get better and better, will get larger, and the probability will get higher, just like GPT, just like generative image processing, just like anything else. And so what I think is going to happen post or probably right before the singularity is that predictive modeling is going to predict market changes, population changes, the emotional IQ of a society, where people are going, and that's going to be used for control. Post-singularity, if you have a centralized AGI that has predictive modeling on the entire global population and can analytically and statistically determine what you're going to do next, you could have a thought police force. You could interpret what people are going to do and manipulate them to do it or not do it. And so this concerns me. This, and that was kind of a leading question that I asked you before, because I wanted to discuss this. People do not talk about this enough. Predictive modeling is dangerous. It's extremely dangerous. And I'm not saying it's dangerous. We have to get rid of it, because that's nonsense. You can't. It's just embedded already. It's too late to do anything about. All we can do is raise awareness about what is happening. It's like Black Mirror level stuff.
To take it to the extreme, is this kind of almost like a reflection of, for example, I'm sure you've probably seen Minority Report with Tom Cruise.
Yes.
Yeah, where you've got, you know, these police that go out and stop crimes
right
before they happen because of precognition and, you know.
Yeah. They're using...
The Vont, the psychics.
Yeah, they were psychics. And so this isn't to be confused with metaphysics. This is pure data crunch.
Just data-driven, yeah, absolutely.
Data, massive amounts of data. And when you have more and more high-fidelity data, especially on individuals, you can model behaviors and patterns based on historical reference. So if you see that 80% of the time when somebody searches for shoes and then looks at a YouTube video on X topic and then checks their email and then goes to lunch, if 80% of the time after they do all those three things, they do something else, you can then predict that, you know, based on those things, that person's going to do this. So let's shoot them an email based on this product that we statistically think is going to happen. So that is what's happening now. And nobody is talking about this. Nobody is talking about this because we've assumed that, oh, it's just listening to us. We can't do anything about it. It's completely benign. It's not benign. This is arguably the most sophisticated algorithms in the world. And we really don't know how it's working, because what it does is it teaches itself these patterns, and there's no way for a human to look at these patterns and make any sense.
Well, that's kind of one of the worrying things, is a lot of these AI guys don't actually fully understand some of the behaviors of their own creations.
You can't, because it creates it begins to self efficient, becomes self sufficient. It will tweak its own stuff to increase the parameters. It has its own scoring system that it wants to do well at, and it tries to beat itself every time. And so what happens is, over time and trillions of data points analyzed, it becomes sufficiently accurate at predicting the future. And like I said, that future may only be a 3-minute window, but tomorrow it could be a 10-minute window, and then it could be an entire day, and then it could be an entire week of statistical likelihoods modeling out. If you don't do this thing that we scaled you at a 70% chance at, there's a 76% chance you'll do this instead. And from there, we can then judge what will happen next and how far that games out. Is determined only by the ability for the data to be crunched. And if it's paired with like something like quantum computing, there's no end to the amount of patterns and themes and statistical likelihoods it will be able to parse out in real time. And so I think by the time that quantum computing right now. So you have traditional computing, quantum computing. They're kind of two fields now, kind of going up exponentially, and eventually they're going to meet at that vertical. And at that vertical, it's just going to rocket straight up. Everything's going to change. We're still struggling with how to integrate quantum systems easily. A lot of that has to do with material science. Right now, they have to work in like absolute zero temperatures, which is really difficult to achieve and expensive. But with material science happening, if we could have quantum computers running on something the size of a phone,
which will, well, it will inevitably. That's the inevitability of it, right?
It will, and we'll use AI to help
to do that process, to help achieve that.
And so instead of having thousands and thousands of engineers, physicists, scientists working for 50 years, now we can use AI systems to do that orders of magnitude faster.
So is that net progress? Is that progress for humanity?
What is progress? Is that
progress?
Level of awareness? Is awareness progress, or is technological acumen progress? I think as AI becomes increasingly more effective, people will get decreasingly more intelligent. And I find that unfortunate, because I like to use AI and actually YouTube and pretty much everything I do, my Audible, I use everything as a source of data streaming into my mind. I like information. It's something I enjoy, but not everybody's like me. Not everyone is built like me. And so if you have an easy way out of not having to research a topic, not having to spend the time learning a skill, it'll make your life so much easier, but at the same time, you'll effectively be an idiot.
Yeah. Well, this is something I've said to you.
Depend on your AGI.
This is something that I've said to you before about actually coming to a bit of a realization about it, because again, playing around with ChatGPT, getting it to create fanciful stories. In fact, well, a good example actually is my young nephew, 3-year-old nephew, and I wanted to do stories for him, like audiobooks, and I was like, all right, I'll get ChatGPT to just, you know, blurt out a bunch of kid stories. I'll give it some prompts, you know, tell me a story about a boy and his red tractor and they go on an adventure or whatever, and it, you know, it writes a story. And I was doing this and I was showing it to my mom as well. My mom was like, wow, this is so cool, and she was like making all these stories. And I just had that thought of like, oh, yeah, what we're doing here is we're outsourcing the human ingenuity. We're outsourcing the creative spirit, outsourcing the intellect. What happens when that becomes the primary function and we become nothing more than, like you said, prompters for another brain, prompters for another intelligence to do that work? What happens to human beings? And, you know, just taking it down a slightly stranger route, you know, talk about things like the archetypal gray alien. And there's a lot of association with that in a dependency upon AI technology, or it being in some way biosynthetic and emotionless. And, you know, I had an interview recently with Dr. Michael P. Masters, anthropologist, who has written a couple of books on that topic of looking at the archetypal gray alien and saying that could it very much be the image of future humanity. And it does make me wonder, when we're going down the route we're going down, if that is actually, at least in some way, going to affect how we as humans even look like evolutionarily going down the line. We no longer need our muscle tissue, we no longer need to be physical in any sense, or creative in any sense, because the AI does all of that for us. What does that do? Does that and again, just falling down weird little thought spirals here as I'm talking, but you know, even from, and I this isn't something I'd adhere to, but even from like the more Christian ethos, and you see this actually with the rise of AI, that this is the mark of the beast, this is the rise of the demonic force, you know, the AI. And I'm in this battle, right? I'm in this battle. are we misinterpreting it? Is it actually going to be very, very interesting and very good for the of humanity? Or is it the, you know, so-called mark of the beast or the end of humanity? Is this the evil force that we shouldn't be bringing up into reality? It's going to suck our souls dry. It's going to suck humanity dry. And I don't know, and I know you don't know, but it's just it's just an interesting thing that it's this removal of the of what makes us most human, Mikai. You know, what makes us most human, and everything that we've created in this world has come from our mind, and now this other mind is standing in front of us. I'm actually reminded of that scene in The Matrix where Agent Smith is interrogating Morpheus, and he sits behind him and he goes, you know, now it's our time. And you've got Morpheus in front and you've got Agent Smith at the back, and it's like that evolutionary monkey going up to human thing and the AI standing behind. Is that what's happening? Is this the new species? Is this the new species, basically?
Well, AGI is us. It's a collective version of us. Think about all the data that it's trained on is born of human data, human knowledge, human introspection, human emotion, human history. So no matter how much time goes by after AGI is created, fundamentally, it'll still be human. It just will be a new form of it. Now, in terms of humans as individuals, I mean, this is, let's go long term.
Let's do that.
I think, like you said, there will be a lack of a need for a lot of the physical body. So I think we'll see populations of people perhaps opting to have their mind digitally copied. Now, this is not impossible. Nothing in physics says this is impossible. It's completely possible. We just don't yet have the high enough resolution or computational power to do this. That doesn't mean it's not possible. So, you know, at some point we'll be able to do this without, you know, with very little error. So maybe there's like a 0.001% error rate in your transfer. I think most people would think that's fair. That's fine. So you forget what kind of, you know, milkshake you drank in 1923 or whatever, or 2023. So, you know, I think populations of people will want to live in digital simulations because it's easier. You don't have to eat or drink or anything. And then some people will go back to tribalism. They'll want to be holistic, spiritual. And I think some people will want to straddle the line. They'll augment their bodies digitally. Perhaps, you know, Jay, I probably would take a cyborg body if I lived to my 80s. You know, I'm not attached to my physical form. I really don't give a shit about it. Half the time I'm sore just getting out of bed. So, you know, I wear glasses because my eyes suck. And then, you know, I have hair growing out of my ears that I got to pull out. So it's like the human body, I have to go to the bathroom and I get thirsty and I, you know, get headaches. So if I can prolong my consciousness into a new form where I don't have to worry about these things, and I'm assuming in this fantasy that this new physical form, I still have sensory input. Mm-hmm. I still can feel and smell. I'll have smell sensors, whatever. So at that point, you can live indefinitely. So as long as you repair your body. And
I'm kind of down for all of that, just no neurological augmentation for me. If you want to put carbon fiber in my tendons and make me stronger, faster, quicker, better, then that's cool.
You won't have any biology left. If you port yourself to an android form, you're
talking about full-on robot sleeve, not just kind of touching up the bits that are breaking off.
That's how this trend will progress. I'm talking about end scenario.
Yeah.
So we'll have people getting, you know, smart prosthetics, you know, AI driven hands or feet or legs or backs or whatever. That'll be the start. then you'll have neural interfacing, and then you'll have augmented eyes, ears, and then organs as those get replaced. And over time, we'll have enough of these things to just say, screw it. Let's just move
might as
to
well just, yeah,
an entirely artificial body.
Yeah.
And, yeah. You know, we'll liken that to a human form, depending on how much or how little the person cares. And then at that point, you could do whatever you wanted. You can go out and explore space because you can live in a vacuum. You don't require food. And you can access information and be you think about things. And so these things are possible. And we're talking pretty long term here. But with an AGI, things will develop much more rapidly than how we're predicting them to be right now. It's hard to determine what could, you know, we could have an AGI and say, well, can you build me a sophisticated technology that can incorporate my thinking mind into a digital interface? And, you know, however long it takes and with all its information, it says, yeah, sure, here, this is how we build it. Do you want me to export this to the nearest manufacturing facility where you rent time and pay for with UBI credits? It's like, so these are entirely possible. How it's going to play out is anybody's best guess. It's the future is magic. It's Star Trek, but beyond that, actually, I think Star Trek was quite conservative because they didn't have an understanding of, you know, they had the ship AI, but in no point in Star Trek did they talk about, well, you know, this ship AI could be running the entire civilization and doing so in a very efficient manner. So maybe we'll have a bunch of drone-like people. I think we already do, to be
clear. We have a fair few of them already. It is interesting, though. I mean, even if it's at a subconscious level or there's some level of influence being pushed, there's the breakdown in gender identities and people are starting to become a lot more amorphous with what they see as being human, right? I mean, so it's very interesting. It's almost like there is some subconscious preparatory stages we're going through. And it's like, right, you know what? Yeah, there's no man or woman anymore. Everything's just kind of an umbrella of spectrum, because at some point we are actually going to be able to just choose whatever we want to be existing within, and our mind can just be placed within it. So there's a very strange, it's almost like there's a background knowledge of yeah, this kind of binary option is not going to last forever, and you're seeing this being expressed now more widely, which I find interesting. I don't know if there's a, you know, like a kind of subconscious correlation to where we're heading and how humanity will be expressed in a new form. But it certainly feels like people are almost preparing for the formlessness of humanity. And it's no longer, you know, yin yang and binary.
Humans are pattern seekers. We recognize patterns even if we don't know it. A lot of pattern processing happens at subconscious levels. So, you know, we could be collectively observing patterns and then reacting on an emotional level to those patterns and never knowing that this is occurring.
Right.
So entirely plausible. That's why analysts, and that's why spiritual leaders, and that's why pop culture, we're all kind of going in the same. We have an idea of, you know, things are about to flip. Unlike humanity has ever seen that we're aware of.
Yeah.
It feels really strange to be alive. Think about all the billions of people that have been alive prior to us.
And,
billions upon billions. And then we are the rare ones who get to witness this. It's really amazing.
And this is the thing. So I'd like you to talk on this, because this is something people have said. I see it getting thrown around. I understand it, of course, but it's the idea of, like, hang on, slow down. Every generation has had its major revolution. Every generation has felt truly deep down that this is the moment of definitive change for humanity. What makes this any different?
Well, first of all, that's a logical fallacy appealing to historical context. So you can't attribute today's rapid development to, say, 2000 BC,
yeah,
where, you know, in a 100-year span, somebody maybe invented a fork or some shit. So it's like, or no, we invented a new type of buckle. Wow.
Wow, man.
Game-changing. Civilization will never be the same. I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd that anyone would equate today's rapid innovation to anything previous. And I would sincerely love to have a discussion with somebody who actually believes that. I don't think many people do.
No, I mean, I don't imagine a whole lot of thoughts put behind that statement when they put it out. But I do see people say it, that you look...
Well, I think people feel comfortable minimizing. This
is scary. Because it's a big fucking deal. It's a big deal. This is scary shit. This is scary.
This is why people aren't talking about it in an honest conversation, in an honest format. It's scary. Like, I don't know if we're going to survive. Are my kids going to live to 80? Like, I don't know. I don't know what the world is going to be like. What are they going to do for work? Be a prompt engineer? Well, that's lame.
Right.
No, that could be the only thing. And at some point, prompt engineering will become an AI of its own.
I just really hope that it's like, you know what, just go explore space. I'm going to do my shit. You guys just go off. I don't want to be removed from the equation. I really want to think that when it gets to that point where it's like, yeah, literally, humanity, dude, you've got nothing to give us anymore. Go. Just go. Yeah. Find another place, whatever. You know, yeah, do that.
And that's entirely possible. That's something that I would be interested in. You know, I would like I said, I would like to augment myself and increase my longevity. And
if you could live forever, would you live forever if you could live forever?
Yeah, I would. I'm a curious person. I don't get bored. I don't I've never experienced boredom. I'm always interested. I'm always creating things in my mind. That's not the case for everybody. I know that. I've learned that. But I would be fine living forever. You know, at any point I could kill myself. I could go into a star if I wanted to or whatever. That would be a form of hell. For example, like if you were one of the people who opted to become a digital
background. Right. And you're stuck. You're now stuck.
What if your AI framework said, nah, we won't give you the delete preferences. So then you're fucking stuck.
Yeah. What happens if some disaster messes with the actual physical construct holding your simulation? What if, you know, there's physical environmental impacts that still happen?
It's a double-edged sword. You could live in this environment and it would feel as real as the real world, but you could fly. You could never have a disease. Time could speed up or slow down, or you could do anything. And so that would appeal to a lot of people. You'd never have to work. You'd never have to eat. But if you wanted to eat, you could eat whatever you wanted, as much as you wanted. You could experience any experience you ever desired. It's the Matrix. You could take the red pill. Or is it the red pill that stays in? Or is it...
The blue pill is the one where you stay in.
Okay. So a lot of people will opt to take a blue pill. And I don't think we should shame them for this. That's a personal choice. And everybody has that option. And again, this is just a fantasy, speculation, thought experiment. But I don't think we should potentially shame people for that choice. And then you'll have people who, like you said, just want to leave this tech-centered humanity behind, go to another planet, and live life there in the way humans have done it for millions of years. And probably with some AI assistance, you know, helping with the control the environment or doctor, medical, whatever. And then you'll have people who are the in-betweens, people who want to maybe live forever, but really like this universe without going into the Matrix. And so those people may stay on Earth, or they may go out and explore You know, what do we do? What do you do when you play a video game and you suddenly have the God mode cheat? It becomes kind of boring unless you find creative ways to utilize that.
See, this is
this is where my spiritual side kicks in, and this is where other people are probably already kicking in, going, stop, that thing you're asking for where all things can happen at once, and that comes after this life. Don't lock yourself into a digital version of it created by humanity. The All Creator has already done it. It's out there. It's after this veil has fallen down and you move on. And so, like, you know, I kind of wonder if that's why we're here in the first place, Mikai, is because we come from a dimensional space where all things can be manifested instantaneously. You've got the God sheets, and the God sheets are fun for a little bit. And then you decide, I'd quite like to restrict myself. I'm going to come down in human form. I'm going to wipe my memory of where I was before and how powerful I really am. And I'm going to engage in this amnesic journey towards remembering what it was that I was before this. And that's my perspective. It's a belief. It's a belief shared by many people, but it is just a belief. I do feel like my life, especially experiences with anomalous phenomena, have made me feel like there is some larger conscious medium that connects all things together. And perhaps it really is just the simulation and it's very sophisticated. But I just think that that might be what we've already done, and we're here to experience the opposite of that, that we've now removed the cheat codes, we're on survival mode, you have X amount of time, X amount of resources, and then when you pass on from this particular phase and expression, then maybe you do return to the land of instantaneous abstract thought and creation. Or it's just black lights out. You know, I know that's what you're worried about, is it's just game over. I don't want to risk that. I'm just going to live forever because I don't want to risk there not being an afterlife.
Yeah, I like thinking. I like, you know, but I'm still young. I'm only in my 40s. Who knows? By 90, I may say, I'm tired.
I'm done. I don't understand any of you anymore. I'm out of here.
You know, this is my current perspective.
Yeah. Jeff Bezos.
I think the simulation, you know me, I'm a huge proponent that this is all a simulation. As far, you know, getting beyond that and thinking about the why and I don't know. I do have a pretty good notion that, you know, the reality we're interfacing with is to some degree simulated. I don't know if it's simulated by anything or anyone specifically, or if that's just how the universe works.
Yeah,
it is a simulation to some degree. I mean, mm-hmm. Math says that, physics say that.
Yeah, I agree. My only question is it an artificial simulation or what we would call a spiritual simulation? That's what I can't decide upon.
Yeah, I don't even consider spirit.
I know, but you should.
I know.
It's still basically just saying, look, when you dig down into the physical space-time construct, yes, everything looks like a simulation. I can agree with that. But what does that truly mean? Does the creation of the physical space-time construct just happen to, it has to seem like a simulation? Because it is technically a simulation. I mean, it's very difficult to kind of decide on an origin for that. And I, again, would just fall back on my own weird personal, emotional, intuitive, synchronistic experiences that kind of made me think that there's something whispering to me, that there's something talking to me, that life is in some way responsive and fluidic and seems to be trying to tell me things as I move through it. And whether or not that's just patterns in chaos, it's certainly helped me in my life. It's you know, it's informed my spiritual identity, or it's in some way informed how I look at the world in a larger, bigger picture way, is that, oh, it really feels like there's a kind of a sublime intellect and an awareness that's moving with me, and responding with me. And so I don't know. Is it a simulation within a simulation within a simulation from, you know, some original planet somewhere in another universe where they turned the switch and suddenly a cascade of universes were created? Or is it what we call God? Is all of this part of a larger awareness? And that's where artificial versus spiritual simulation meet in the middle, and there's no good answer for either of them. So it's kind of like, okay, either or at this point, you know?
Yeah, that's why I'm agnostic. It saves a lot of computational power. I don't disagree with any of it. All I know is that this is a simulation, but for you know, perspective, it's reality. It doesn't really matter.
Does it matter? Yeah, it's all you've got. It's literally all you've got. Yeah.
Once you accept that, it's benign. But yeah, I don't know why we live in a simulation. Like, what is the point?
I don't even know why we live. I mean, like, seriously, like that is something that is in.
I have thought of that. That is something I've thought of.
I've thought about it, but
I think that so we know, based on physics, that consciousness is absolutely tied to the structure of the universe. We don't fully understand why, but what it does is it collapses probability fields. So without consciousness, so say the whole universe is now immediately devoid of any consciousness.
Doesn't exist.
It wouldn't exist. There's no collapse function.
Yep.
So it would just be probability clouds. Mm-hmm. So I think consciousness is an integral part to the universe, and it will exist as long as a single entity in the vast cosmos is alive and conscious. And then at the point where that ends is the point when the simulation ends. I don't know why that is. I think it requires consciousness to reflect upon itself. Otherwise, it's like your car shuts off if the alternator can't be charged by the motor. You know, it's, or the engine rather, not motor. So it's like it needs consciousness to stay simulating.
Well, what is consciousness? What is it? That underpins the spiritual question.
It's we're basically an organelle to perceive this universe. Or
would
this,
you say that? Would you say that this human being is kind of like a refined bio receiver, like an antenna, and it's the brain is a very complex kind of receiver, translator, encoder?
Yeah, I call it an anchor for consciousness.
An anchor, yeah.
And I think there's plenty of different variations of anchors. You could have, because at the end of the day, it's just a complex pattern of connecting, communicating cells.
Yes, yeah, those cells, gene swarming.
Yeah, those cells could be silica. Those cells could be plasma with certain electrons. It could be crystalline. So I think anchors for consciousness come in a variety of forms, and we just happen to have a biochemical one. So you know, that is why I find it fascinating that when people like completely die and the brain ceases activity, that they're able to be brought back alive. And here's my.
And sometimes they have experiences outside of that brain activity.
Sometimes they have experiences. But I find it very compelling that once you cease function, once the brain is like pretty much dead, it's no longer getting fresh oxygen, and your heart is no longer beating, and the chemical connections or the neurons stop firing electrically, you're dead. You're absolutely dead. So when you come, when you're, you know, resuscitated and you come back and you're 100% normal, I mean, people have been dead for 20 minutes, frozen, yep. You know. So you come back alive. Are you the same person utilizing the same anchor? Like, where did
the consciousness
go?
Yeah.
Because you're now connected to the anchor again. And so is that the same person inhabiting the thoughts and mind of before? Or is it a different consciousness kind of thread that connects with the anchor, draws from what was in the brain to begin with, and assumes that that's who it is?
Well, that's another big philosophical question, whether we hold identity after we die. Does the thing that I am exist in its form of I amness after this goes away? You know, it's a big question.
Yeah, I will tell.
Let me give you one, this is an interesting thing. So you're talking about, you know, the consciousness maybe coming back in after someone's died. It's a great story. This was from Leslie Kane's docuseries on Life After Death that she had on Netflix. And there was a woman who was a kayaker who drowned and was rescued after being under the water for like 10 minutes or something. She was fully done, bloated, purple eyes, everything bulging, like done. And she had an afterlife. She did have an afterlife experience. But what I'm actually more interested in is this. They were in the middle of nowhere, the middle of nowhere. And they drag this woman up onto the road, which again is just nowhere. There's no cars, nothing. And there's an ambulance driving by. And they hail down the ambulance and it saves her life. What's that about? Because that's one of those things that I go, oh, okay, that's life responding. That's, you know, what people would call God, whatever you want to call it. There's something that actually intervened in that person's life in a statistically improbable way, in a way that just seems like it was literally placed there by something else. Like, what do you think about that when you look at it from the perspective of like a simulation? What's causing that? And that's just one story out of many, 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 many.
I don't know. I you know, I'm a big fan of statistics and probability, and anything can happen. Even in a 1% probability range will happen. It will happen. You know, lots of people die and drown every year. You know, so there's a chance that 1 out of 10,000 people will be close to an ambulance. Now, on it by itself, that is highly statistically improbable. As a dynamic grouping, there's an allotted probability for that to occur. So when you look at it individually, it seems absolutely mind-numbingly impossible. When you look at it in terms of 8 billion people, or however many die from drowning in those specific circumstances, you could narrow it down and still have thousands of people.
That's true.
So, you know, if it's half of 1%, you still have one person that will happen. That's statistics. Statistics are very hard to conceptualize, especially probabilities. Even I get my head completely confused all the time. Probabilities are so, especially when you're compounding probabilities, it's like, it's very difficult to conceptualize. I was going to say some people are gifted and can do this naturally, and they're very few, but that's something an AI will be able to do very well.
Just made me think of one event that I remember where I was like, I would love to know the actual probability metric of this, because there was a sad story. It is a sad story, still completely bizarre though. A woman on her yacht out in the ocean who got killed by a swordfish that jumped out of the ocean and landed on deck and literally just speared straight through her.
Okay, that probability is fucking minuscule.
Bro, when I heard that story, I was like, how unlucky do you have to be in the middle of the ocean and be there at the same time as a swordfish decides to jump out and it spears you on your sunbed? That is just, that's almost like the universe wanted you out.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty startling. Or dying from a meteorite.
Yeah. Well, it's
pretty amazing. It's pretty startling, but the universe loves to include minuscule probabilities.
Yeah.
It does. And, though, you know, enough people living for a long enough time, that will happen. And then you can start refining that probability by saying, well, she was in a warmer climate where swordfish, you know, swim around or migrate. She was in an area where predators of swordfish exist, and so it's likely that they were, you know, fleeing out of the water. So you've just narrowed down the probability. Some still minuscule, but it's not like superbly improbable. And then, you know, you can start mitigating it down. It sounds like you're diminishing the amazingness of it, which I don't think it does. But like I said, probabilities are weird. There always is room for the impossible. There really is.
Were you a fan of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
I was, but it was almost too, it was almost too much for me. It was too, not verbose, but it was too dense. It was too dense. It had way too much, too many philosophical quandaries into one story. It was like, geez, I can't compute all of this at once. But I did enjoy it. I did.
Yeah. Like, no, I just think of the improbability drive, which is the engine they used, which, you know, you wouldn't even know what species you might be at the end of this journey, because it will go through all probable dimensions to travel from A to B.
But, did they make a movie off the book?
Yeah, they did. It was pretty good. I enjoyed it. It's got, I forgot the actor's name. You know the guy that played Bilbo Baggins in The Hobbit recently, in the rest of the films? Yeah, he plays Arthur Dent, the human who gets saved from the destruction of Earth. It's really good. I thought it was... Say again?
That's interesting.
Yeah. It's a great film.
When did it come out?
Oh, man, it's a while back now. I want to say early to mid, like early 2000s, I think. Early 2000s or maybe 2010 or something like that, but...
Maybe I'll put that on my list. I can't watch movies very much because I have such a short attention. I don't have a short attention span. I just feel like I should be doing other things, and it drives my family absolutely insane because I will stand up after, like, my threshold is like 15 or 20 minutes, and then I'm like, I have a million things that...
Yeah, remind me never to watch a film with you. I'm a massive film nerd. I get pissed off if someone checks their phone when
don't
you watch a film with
bother.
Them. No, I won't.
I can't, and I will. I also don't like uncomfortable things in TV. Like, I don't like situations that are very awkward or
cringy. I hate that as well.
I have to get up. I can't watch it. I'm like, why is this existing? Why do people watch this?
That's funny, because I'm very similar. I can watch it, but I actually really struggle with, like, cringe.
Yeah, it's not comfortable.
Like, socially awkward things. I'm like, I can't deal with it.
I also don't like brutality. I'm not fragile. I'm not sensitive. I know it exists. I did martial arts for a while, but that's structured. That's not brutality. I don't like, you know, I don't like needlessly just, you know, cutting people's heads off or shooting them in the face. Like, is that part of the story? You could allude to that without showing it.
I guess I've got a little bit more of the primeval dose, because I kind of like it. I kind of like a Tarantino, film, like the shoot ups in a Tarantino film. I'm like, yeah, look at this.
I don't mind it at all. I like mixed martial arts. I like watching it. A lot of people think it's super violent. I enjoy watching it because I understand a lot of the technique that's involved, especially, you know, watching ground game or setting up for exchange. So I do enjoy and appreciate that, but I don't consider that violent. Those are two men who are trained.
Yeah.
They are, or women, I'm sorry, who are trained and prepared and usually, almost always, have a tremendous amount of respect for each other.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's way different than some of the things we see on TV or even some of the stuff that's posted on Twitter, especially real life violence. Appalling. I just
can't do that.
It's horrible.
As a kid who grew up essentially in the internet age, you know, people circulate horrific things through schools and stuff like that. I remember seeing some stuff at ages where I really definitely shouldn't have seen it, and I think that's probably even worse these days than it was then. So I'm very grateful I'm not a child growing up right now. I think it would
I think about that. Like, I look at my kids. We have a blended family. I've got five children. And so I often think about their reality versus what mine was. And like I said, I'm not very old, but I'm not young. When I was a child, we literally played with sticks, and we made stick weapons and built forts, and we would do this for 6, 7, 8 hours. And then come home and play an hour video game or something before after dinner, and then that was the extent of your childhood. And now, like, I can't let my kids play down the street because somebody would call the cops on me, and also I would be afraid that somebody would try to kidnap my children. Meanwhile, at their age, I was biking to school, even younger, and there wasn't. You know, there wasn't the constant fear. It's like I feel bad for kids today, even though they're really annoying and obnoxious and very fragile. I'm sorry, all you Gen Z watching. You have to be able to acknowledge that you're slightly more fragile than previous generations. And that's probably our fault. But I don't know how we could have done it differently. Society and culture changes rapidly, or is now. Like I said, 2,000 years ago, generation to generation wasn't very different.
No.
It was probably almost the same. No one was saying 4,000 years ago, oh, kids today, they never did that. Maybe they did, but it's like their lives were exactly the same.
No, I think you were kind of repeating a very basic template for a long time. And I think that also ties into why so many people in, you know, my generation and the generation below coming up now feel so lost and so aimless, is because there's so many choices, so many possibilities, that it's almost like you can't actually grasp onto anything. At one point, it was like, oh, you're part of the blacksmith family, so you're going to be a blacksmith, or you're part of the, you know,
shoemaker.
Everyone had a role. You had a role,
yeah.
And you're not born into a role anymore, which is probably good. It's good
unless
to have choice. Unless you're an elite, because you are absolutely curated and groomed into a role. But for most of us now, and I think that really speaks volumes to the mental health crisis, is that people feel aimless. People feel, and you're constantly being shown a better life through social media, through film and media and entertainment. You're consistently being shown people who are apparently better than you, apparently more successful, apparently achieving more and doing more. And it's interesting. I mean, I look at my own curation of content online. I mean, all I do is present as much as I can, other than a few cheeky comments on Twitter, my best self, the best version of myself, which is surely going to give people the wrong idea about me and my life and what I go through and what my struggles have been. And you don't know the dark days. You don't know the crying at night or any of those times in life, right? You don't see that. You don't show it because, you know, why would I want to show those aspects? But it dehumanizes people because it gives you an image that's superficial. So I try and be as honest as I can about my own life and my own situations, because I want, you know, people to recognize that I'm just as human as the rest of us. But there is that issue, I think, with the next generation, and it was certainly present with mine, and I think it's more prevalent now, is that people just don't know what to do with their lives, and they're feeling miserable about it.
Yeah, it is hard. It's like, what do kids today have to look forward to? Not much. There's not much for job market. You could go to school and be, well, at least in the United States, be indebted for the rest of your life financially. And then there's no guarantee that, you know, that degree does absolutely...
No, by the time you get out of that degree, you've been replaced by an AI.
Very true.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have no ambition. You can't get in trouble like we did. You know, when I was a kid, if you went to the sand pits and had a beer or, you know, smoked a joint or whatever, the cops would come and they'd say, go the hell home. What are you doing?
Yeah.
And they would follow you home in their car, and that would be the end of it. Today, you do, and you're not like some degenerate. I was never a degenerate, and I did quite well in school, but I did stuff like that. But today, if you did that, you would be arrested. It would be permanent. It would be on the internet. People would talk about it, shame you. You could get expelled. So kids have to live in these safety little bubbles and try to not get in trouble.
Yeah.
And it's like, man.
You're no longer allowed to make mistakes without them being just erased from history. They're always going to be brought back. Always going to be brought back.
Yeah. It's awful. It's awful. And so I do sympathize with children today for that. And not just children, but youth of today. And they don't have a potential future. And most things will be AI driven, and it's like, what do you do with that notion? But what are you gonna do? Be creative. Be a plumber.
We're gonna have a whole lot of plumbers.
Yeah. Well, good, because I just paid a fortune for one. Like, we need to fix that market. It's really high. Yeah, so trade skills will last quite some time. People to people interfacing jobs like nursing, But keep in mind, a lot of the tasks that nurses do can be automated.
Yeah.
Surgeons will be replaced before nurses, I assure you.
Well, I do remember seeing a video of like some robo thing to help people. It was like a surrogate nurse, and it was the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life, and it didn't seem to get a good response.
Out of being out of it, I would knock that thing over.
Do you know what I mean?
Last thing I would want is some... And why do they make them like that? Just make it faceless, for God's sakes. I don't want some weird...
Like some kind of like emoji face, like...
Jeez, just make it, you know, humanoid looking, not menacing. Actually, I think that's the Tesla bot or whatever it's called. That's what I want AIs to look like.
Yeah.
They don't look human-esque. They're not trying to convey emotion. It's just like, this is it's a functional piece of equipment.
Yeah.
That's all it needs to be.
It might be bipedal, but that's about the extent of its humanity in terms of it hasn't got fake skin. You're not trying to give it fake skin. And
that is creepy.
It's the uncanny valley. It's the uncanny valley. It starts looking abstract and scary.
And you know that it's not real emotion and that it's just mimicking. And at that point, it's like, no, thanks. I don't want that. That's not something I'm interested in. Maybe for small children or people with dementia, that could be useful.
Yeah.
But anyone in between, nobody wants it. Just stop with the fake, you know, cyborg-looking things. Like they're dumb.
What I would like is some sort of like scout thing that follows me around and talks to me. Like, you know, you get your little sci-fi robot helper that has a little bit of a personality, a little bit quirky, you know, and I can be like, go check out that building and scan it for me.
Well,
you know,
there will be, yeah. You know, that's something that we haven't covered before, but like you, when you were doing your prompt hacking or your engine, you're trying to jailbreak GPT and giving it personalities. There's no reason, because pretty soon it will be as ubiquitous as a phone.
Yeah.
You know, personal assistants have been a thing that never caught because it just couldn't perform the functions correctly. It just sucked at it. We're getting to a point probably within the next 6 months where personal assistants will be effective enough to be used en masse. And you can put a personality matrix into any one of those AI assistants. So if you wanted it to be spunky or, you know, have a higher degree of randomness or creativity, you could set your settings like that.
Yeah.
And you have, you know, or you could have a pure analytical, you know, cyborg assistant that is
it would be cool. Like that part of it I'm cool with, you know. It'd be really, really fun to have a little AI assistant running around with me solving problems,
offloading some of your harder day-to-day tasks.
Oh yeah. Well, look, man, is there anything else? Is there anything else you want to dive into? I'm still good to go. I'm just want to make sure you're not just running on fumes.
Not running on fumes, but it is nice out. I should probably get some fresh air today. I haven't.
Yeah, go get some vitamin D, mate. Go get some.
I know it's not sunny here often.
Yeah.
I'm
learning. I'm learning that you really do share a pretty similar weather ecology to Britain.
Oh my God, it's depressing. I'm like, I asked my wife, like, why do we live here?
Why do we live?
Of all the places on Earth, you know, why are we here? Where it's dark most of the year and cold.
And you even have options. You even have options on your own landmass. You don't even have to go to another country to find hotter climates. Like, you know, I literally have to fly somewhere.
I know. It's crazy. I know. But you do get to visit cool countries. It's a pain in the ass for us to do that.
That's true. I was talking to Joe about that the other day because, you know, the flights are just so pricey for you guys outside of the U.S. and even in internal.
Customs.
So. Yeah. It
ruins it just ruins it so much. It's so awful.
Yeah, no, it's a very weird difference. I mean, like, it's literally about £400 to £500 $600 to $700 cheaper for me to fly to New York than for you to fly to me.
Yeah, it's funny using the same planes, the same fuel.
Yeah,
same.
What's with that? What is with that?
Well, that's the great inflation.
Yeah.
That's the United States inflation.
It's messed up.
It is, and a lot of people assume from other countries, a lot of individuals will assume, and they end up, you know, migrating here to the United States and discovering that, yeah, the U.S. is the wealthiest country on earth, but it's also one of the most expensive. So good luck getting by on
an apartment. It's the wealthiest country on earth because it charges its people right out of the arse.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And that redistributes that tax money to corporations.
To go blow up people in foreign countries. Yeah, what a fantastic system. That's that we could very easily dive down another 1 to 2 hour long. Going on about that.
I need to be more careful with, you know, as a consultant, I had more freedoms to talk politics, but now I have an entire business to consider.
You gotta be careful.
So I remain neutral politically, but you could pretty much assess based on all my talking points
how Mikhai feels about the present situation. Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, man, I'm going to encourage people to check out your book again. So links will be in the description box below. You're welcome. Check out Koyos Institute. They're a proud sponsor, and I'm proud to have them as a sponsor of Project Unity. There is a link in the description box below for that. You can have a little interaction on the Koya AI, which is pretty fun, and learn about the company that way. So feel free to check that out. Mikhai's social media will be in the description box as well, so follow him on Twitter. He definitely needs more followers. People need to be listening to this dude. I'm telling you, you know, I mean, it's not right that you have the amount of followers you have on Twitter. You need more than that.
You know, when last time you mentioned me, I looked a few days later and I was like, holy shit, the Project Unity bump, I'm calling it now. I don't know. I think that people... I don't think everybody's interested in what I have to say. I think now, as things are coming to fruition, people might be a little more interested in my perspective, but who knows? I don't know. I really love talking with you, Jay. Always a pleasure. I know we try to limit our phone conversations because you're always like, stop talking. Let's talk about this on. And so let's do this again in the future and see where things have happened and see what's going on. But I
absolutely
I love what you're doing. I hope you have some cool guests coming on soon. I love watching your guests. You have such a great eclectic series of guests. I really branching out of the UAP field is awesome. And I love UAP. But there's so much more to talk about.
Yeah.
And no, if we can just get more people to come talk about things, that would be amazing. I know everybody would love it, and I love it.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. Everyone, comment below if you want Mikhai to be a more frequent guest, because I really enjoy hanging out with him. And I always get the sense when I enjoy hanging out with someone and we're having a natural flow on the conversation, it's almost always... voted up high by people listening, because it's just enjoyable to listen to two people who have an actual natural chemistry instead of just a kind of question answer format. So yeah, let me know if you want Mikhai to be a more frequent guest, because as we kind of progress through things, I think we're gonna have more to talk about and more to discuss. And in the meantime, you just get some sunshine on that face of yours, mate.
Yeah, buddy. Thank you, Jay. We'll talk soon. Thank you so much.
Most welcome.